For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
All right. Well, this is our last week in Thessalonians. We're going to study four verses this morning. And then next week, we go into the book of Daniel. So these final words from 1 Thessalonians, this is from Paul to this group of believers in this area of northern Greece today. It was called Macedonia at that time. And let's just read the passage together. Verse 12. He says, "Dear brothers and sisters, honor those who are your leaders in the Lord's work. They work hard among you and give you spiritual guidance. Show them great respect and wholehearted love because of their work, and live peacefully with each other. Brothers and sisters, we urge you to warn those who are lazy, encourage those who are timid, take tender care of those who are weak, be patient with everyone. See that no one pays back evil for evil, but always try to do good to each other and to all people." So what we have here is real practical advice. He's talking about how you deal with people that are in spiritual leadership roles. When he says, honor those that work hard among you in the Lord. And then he also then gives a set of commands about warning, about encouraging, about helping, about being patient. So this is real practical stuff. And I think that each of us, there's going to be something hopefully that we can take away from this today. So let's look at this verse 12 where he says, "Dear brothers and sisters, honor those who are your leaders in the Lord's work. They work hard among you and give you spiritual guidance." I want to look at this piece by piece. So when he says, "Dear brothers and sisters," this is a command to everybody that's in this group of believers. We call this the church, because the church is not an institution, but it's a group of people that are followers of Jesus. He says, what I'm calling you to do is honor those. And the word honor, what it means, like respect, to regard highly. Who? Those who are leaders in the Lord's work, those who are the spiritual leaders. And what we're going to talk about today is this whole notion of spiritual leadership. Because in the church, it's clear that God appoints certain people to act as leaders of others. And we're going to talk about some of the negativity that we might have towards authorities and that kind of thing. But when we come into the church, these people that are following Jesus together, God chooses some people to be leaders. And this is something that he has done. You know, he could have worked in a lot of different ways, but the way God has chosen to work is through people. I mean, I guess maybe he could have put angels down here to be spiritual leaders, or he could just do it in some ethereal way. But he does it in a mystical way that's real. That is his spirit, the mystical presence of God in another person that acts as a leader for God. And so God works through what we call delegated authority, that he delegates authority to people, his authority given to people to lead then in a spiritual sense. And because of that, he says that when we are in a situation of spiritual leadership and there's this community, he says to the rank and file, to the brothers, he says you should honor those who are your leaders. And we're going to talk about why. And he says, for one thing, they work hard among you and give you spiritual guidance. So this working hard is a word that means like toil that results in fatigue and exhaustion. That it's hard work. And when we look at our setting, most of the leaders in this church, because we have these home churches, they're serving as volunteers. That this is at the expense of maybe their comfort, maybe even their income, that their sleep, their convenience, their stress. And despite they give these things up, why? So that they can work hard, so that they can strive to serve God and to love others. And it says they give you spiritual guidance. Now, there's one part of this that we need to sort of focus in on. Because I don't know exactly what it means about the translation. But here's the thing. What we read here is a translation from the original text, which was in Greek. And this phrase where it says they work hard among you, the literal translation is much different. In fact, the New International Version, NIV, see how it says, who are over you in the Lord and who admonish you? Do you see a difference between among you and are over you? Is there a little difference there? I mean, among you, it's sort of like this is a player coach, which is true in one sense, but I think there's a nuance here that's neglected when we lose sight of this word. The real word, that's the Greek word that's translated among you and is translated in the NIV, are over you, is really important. And I wonder if the New Living Translation is the most modern translation, if in some way it's even a response to the anti-authoritarian view that we have. How many people like to think that there's someone who's over us? We don't like that, do we? Why is it? I guess Americans have never wanted anybody over them, right? It just goes to the very spirit of almost rebelliousness. And that's just not Americans. That's the way all people are. That we sort of, we recoil against the thought that someone would have authority over me. And you see, what the scriptures are getting at here is there's a different way of viewing authority. If we view all authority that way, then what are we going to do? That means we're viewing the authority of God in that same way, and we recoil against it. I think a great example of this is this fellow. World's best boss, Michael Scott. You know, and everyone knows that the office functions perfectly because he's a great leader, right? No, he is the least competent person in the office, isn't he? I mean, the janitors, the guys in the stockroom, everyone, they know what's happening, but he doesn't. He's clueless. In fact, what he does undermines the success of the company. And it's just so much fun to laugh at and poke fun at the boss. And a lot of times this is the way it is in our workplace. At least we feel that way. And here's the danger. This is funny to laugh at and everything, but the danger is this. If we allow this anti-authoritarian and even a cynical view of authority to spill over into the way we view things spiritually, it's going to hurt us. It's going to hurt us. Because you know what? If God, if this is true, if what we're talking about is true, if God has appointed people to be spiritual leaders and to help us grow spiritually, and we look at them with cynicism, we regard their input to our lives, their correction of us maybe, their teaching of us, if we regard that with contempt and with cynicism, then we are going to, we're going to hurt. And our whole community is going to hurt. And so the scriptures are saying, hey, here is a different way to view authority. And we do so because of the way that the scripture talks about authority. And it really goes back to the words of Jesus. When he's talking about the way leadership should be done, it's in the form of like a shepherd. He says, I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. And this then is the model for spiritual leadership. When he meets Peter after Jesus is resurrected, Peter says, basically, I want to follow you, Jesus. And he says, tend my sheep. Care for the lambs. Care for the people that are around you. That's how you can honor me. That's how you can love me, Peter. And Peter became then one of the chief shepherds or leaders of that whole movement. And so what I'd like to think about for a second, when he says, the good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep, who's he prioritizing here? Is it his? No, it says he puts himself on the line for the sake of others, for the sheep, right? And so let's take a few lessons. Lessons, that is, in leadership from shepherds. First of all, they care about the needs of the sheep. There's a psalm, Psalm 23, where it talks about God being the great shepherd. And he leads them into green pastures. And Jesus, when he's talking about being the good shepherd, he says that the shepherd goes before the sheep. He leads out in front, and the sheep follow him. Back then, the sheep were more like pets even. And so the shepherd could even call. He'd have a special whistle or call, and his sheep would come right out, and they would follow him. He would set the path, and where did he go? He took them to a pasture where they could feed. He took them to water. He knew their needs, and he provided for those, and that's what the model of servant leadership is in the church. And there are many of you here who serve in these kind of roles where you pray for people, you think about them, and as a leader, that's what God calls us to do, to pray for others, to think about them, to think what other people need so that they can grow spiritually, so that they can have the maximum provision from God. Well, the other thing the shepherd did is he protects the sheep, and he had this thing called a staff. And he'd use this staff, you know, he'd sort of gently nudge the sheep. Probably if one got out of hand, he might smack it upside the head. I don't know. But he had this staff, and this staff he would use then to fight off wild animals too. David, King David, he grew up as a shepherd. And he gave accounts where he killed a bear, he killed a lion. You know, they're coming after his sheep. And he stood before the attack and took it on. And Jesus said, here's how you can know the difference between the shepherd and the other guy's called the hireling, just a hired hand, versus the one that really cared about the sheep. He says, because when the attack comes, the hireling flees. A lion? You know, this is just mutton on hoof. I'm out of here, you know. Let him eat, then I'll come back and I'll see what's left over. But you see, the good shepherd, he stands ground before even a lion to protect these sheep. And you see, that's the way Jesus was. That's the model he gives us. And he says, as a spiritual leader, there needs to be a preparedness in our soul that we would stand ground if there was a threat. Maybe that threat would be a doctrinal threat where God's truth is threatened. Maybe it would be the threat of someone that was menacing, or someone that was trying to hurt people either emotionally or spiritually in the groups that we work in. Maybe there's conflict or there's bitterness that's hurting people. Are we willing to take these things on? And I know a lot of you are. It sounds difficult. It is at times. But see, God gets behind that. Why? Because he wants unity in the church. He wants us to promote love. He wants his way to be promoted within the church. So we have these kind of opportunities. And what it comes down to is that they sacrificially care for the sheep, that they're not most concerned about their own comfort, their own convenience, their own happiness, their own joy. You see, but the paradox of the whole thing is that's where their joy really comes from too, doesn't it? Their joy comes from helping these sheep in this mature and be a flock. And in the church, the joy of the leader comes from seeing God at work in their midst. And so the bottom line is that spiritual leadership is servant leadership. You see, Jesus put it like this. Let's read this carefully. Mark 10, it says, so Jesus called them together. These are his disciples. And he said, you know that the rulers in this world lord it over their people, and officials flaunt their authority over those under them. And now that's familiar, right? And this is the kind of authority that we sort of that we just recoil against. We think, that's what we're talking about. Yeah, they just want their own way. He says, but among you, it will be different. See that in 43? Whoever wants to be a leader among you must be your servant, and whoever wants to be first among you must be the slave of everyone else. For even the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve others and to give his life as a ransom for many. It says, whoever wants to be first, look at 44, among you must be the slave of everyone else. This is Jesus' model. And he says, even the Son, even God's Son, Jesus himself, he's the ultimate model. The ultimate model of this kind of service, because he gave his own life as a sacrifice, as a ransom for many. So when we look then at leadership in the church, I thought it would be good just to understand in this church, in Xenos Christian Fellowship, how our structure is set up, leadership. We have a board of elders. We have 8 men and 1 woman in our board of elders. And our elders are chosen by the other elders and appointed, but then confirmed by our group of our home church leader team. Confirms them and then periodically votes on whether or not to keep these elders on staff. Then we have sphere leaders. Now, Xenos started as a Bible study in a house down on campus by some hippies back in the 70s, okay? These are like Jesus people. Dennis McCallum and Gary DeLashment were really the founders, along with Dennis's mother, Martha. So they started a Bible study in a house. They called it the Fish House, and that's what it was called, the Fish House Fellowship, for years. And then it sort of has grown as a home church sort of movement. And as we've grown, you know, the weekly attendance in Xenos, all ages, is between 4,000 and 5,000. But instead of growing into one mega church, we've split into these smaller congregations, and we call these spheres. So this is a sphere is a team of home churches. And then, like, we have our meeting. You know, there's one that comes in here after us. There's one in the auditorium over there that meets at 9:30, one that meets at 11:30. There's a meeting on campus right now, and there's one later in the morning. Then there's one here in the evening. Then we have one on Monday night, one on Thursday night down on campus. Then there's one on the west side, and there's one on the east side. So there are all these different congregations within this larger congregation. Each one of those has their own pastor or sphere leader. And then the heart and soul of this church, though, is our home church leaders. Because, like, in this group, we have, I think, 17 or 18 groups in here. Each one of those groups has, you know, a couple or two couples or three that are the leaders of that group. And these leaders are all leading as volunteers. And they take on the responsibility, and all the joy that comes with this kind of a position. When it comes to looking for spiritual leaders, how do you decide who's a leader? Is it that we sort of apply for a position and we appoint leaders? Well, our basic philosophy is this, that we recognize spiritual leaders. We don't appoint them. See the difference? If we do is just choose people and say, you're a leader, go lead that group, that's one thing. But if we recognize, in other words, we look and see who is serving people, who is loving people, who's investing their lives in these people and praying for them and helping them grow, that's a spiritual leader. That's the shepherd kind of leader that we're talking about. And so it's pretty simple. The Bible calls all of us to be this kind of a person, to be a giving person, to give our love to others. And that's why we believe that a lot of people, I pray that a lot of you would aspire to this kind of thing. Because this is where, I think, the heart and soul of real contentment and real joy in life is being able to help other people grow spiritually. And we all have that kind of an opportunity. So we look around and we say, who is leading? Who's helping other people grow? Those are the leaders. Because it's a lot different if you have someone that's maybe they're not a natural leader, but they're leading by serving and loving others, and others are following. It's that simple. So that's how we sort of set things up here. And so when you think about your own situation, you've got some spiritual leaders around you, and you think, how then should we respond to spiritual leadership? Well, look and see what the text says. The first part of it was, and this is right there in verse 12, honor those who are your leaders in the Lord's work. That's respect them. And then he goes on in 13, he says, show them great respect and wholehearted love because of their work. Yeah, give them respect, give them love, show them appreciation. You know, by nature, we're not really very appreciative people, are we? Well, our default is to say, what have you done for me lately? You know, and I think that one of the problems that we have, especially when it comes to our church experience, is that, you know, as Americans, a lot of people grow up going to church. And when you grow up going to church, what do you think? Well, there's the pastor and then there's me. And who does the work of the church? Me, right? No. Well, a few people are awake. The pastor does. And like a lot of people said, the church, by and large, is an organization where there needs to be a lot more involvement. And it's more like a football game, the church at large. That's where there's like 22 people on the field that need a rest and 50,000 in the fans that need some exercise. And that's kind of the way the church is. It needs stirred up. And I think that a lot of times, though, we're bringing this kind of a mentality even into our home churches, where we think, well, you know, they're the leaders. Why don't they do something about this? There's this problem. You know, our group is sort of boring. I didn't really like that teaching. I wasn't really entertained enough tonight. You know, I mean, we feel that way sometimes. And so here, just think what's at the root of that, though. Here I am. I'm coming in here, and here's someone serving as a volunteer. They're working hard at this, and I'm coming in, and I'm whining, and I'm complaining because they're just not doing enough for me. Wah, wah, wah. You know, it's just baby. It's babification. It's so infantile. It's really hard to believe, but I know how it is. I feel that way sometimes. It's like, come on, you know, couldn't you do a little bit better for me? And so there's something to think about here, because it says, with wholehearted love because of their work. So it is a change in mentality towards our leaders, where we think, I want to be cooperative. What can I do to help? Versus, why am I so critical? You know, if you feel like you're that way, join the club. That's just the way we are by nature. You know, we're just looking out for our own things, and we're not really engaged in thinking about this bigger picture. But you see, by God's Spirit, and He reveals this kind of stuff to us. That's why it's so good to study the Scripture verse by verse, because stuff like this comes up, and it hits right at the core of who we are. So, and then He says, finally He says, and live peacefully with each other. Man, there again, there's so much strife when you get to know people, and there's a lack of peace, and there's conflicts that come up. And He says, what we need to do is try, by God's grace, then, to fight for peace. He says, be diligent to preserve the unity in the body of Christ. What a difference there is in a church that's structured like this. And look at this. This is Hebrews 13. It says, obey your spiritual leaders and do what they say. Now, wow, that sounds rough, doesn't it? You know, it's a wonder they didn't edit that one, too. Or maybe it should say, take the suggestions of your spiritual leaders and consider. You know, that's not what it says. Now think about it. Why would it say this? Well, God's never going to call you to do something that's immoral. There may be somebody that has a position of spiritual leader that is a bad player. And it happens all the time. We can't avoid that. It's going to happen. But, you know, if someone calls you to do something immoral, you're not going to obey that. But there should be a certain inclination when you see people that are bona fide spiritual people, they're following God. When they give you advice, what you should think is, this very likely is from God, because God's put this person here in my life. What a different perspective than just thinking, you know, because our tendency is to sit like this. I don't know, man. I'll think about it. You know, that's just our ego. You know, our ego just swells up. I don't want to obey anybody. I know how this feels. So God's calling on us to have a different perspective here. Obey your spiritual leaders. Do what they say. Their work is to watch over your souls. And they are accountable to God. How about that? See, God appoints people as His authorities to help other people grow. That's just the bottom line. To watch over your souls. They are accountable. And it says, give them reason to do this with joy and not with sorrow. You know what it's like. You can make it hurt. And some of us really know how to do that well, don't we? But then I love the way He ends it. He says, that would certainly not be for your benefit. You know, if your disposition towards the authorities that God's put in your life is negative, it's questioning, it's cynical, you're hard to please, you're just one of these sort of surly kind of people. He says, the person that's going to suffer the most is you. I'm so glad he gives us this warning. Because, you know, that the scriptures want us to grow. He wants us to benefit. He wants us to have joy. And he says, so one way you can do this is be cooperative, be supportive, love the people that God has put in your life as spiritual leaders. And so when it comes to this whole notion of spiritual leadership, here's what Jesus said. He says, the harvest is plentiful and the workers are few. That there's a spiritual harvest out there. There's a lot to be done. You know, we look around at a dark world and we realize there's a lot of change that needs. How's it going to happen? He says, this plentiful harvest, he says, I want to call more. In fact, he follows this up and he says, pray that more workers would be sent into that harvest. And that's my prayer. That many of us might decide this is something we want to do. And how are you going to do? Well, you're going to find ways to give to others. And one thing you can do is get trained. Get trained in spiritual things. And that's, you know, we have our home churches here. A lot of our home churches have like men's groups and women's groups. And then we have our classes. And actually, starting winter quarter, which is like one of the first weeks in January, there's something you can think about and pray about. We pick up our classes again, and Ryan, who teaches the second central teaching here, and I, we've been for the last year and a half been going through our basic core classes, and we're going to talk, this class is called Spiritual Growth. Our Spiritual Growth class, it's a 9-week class. It's like 2 hours a week on Wednesday nights. I'd encourage you, come out. If you haven't taken a class, take that class and begin to get trained, because you see, spiritual leadership needs to be spiritually informed. Biblically informed. And this is one way you can begin to grow that base so that you have spiritual content to give to other people. Secondly, I'd say modify your schedule and prioritize your spiritual life. Why modify your schedule? Anybody here have a lot of extra time? Free time? Free time is something we don't have, do we? I guess some of us do. Not many of us. And so what's that mean? Well, if I don't have any free time, then I've got to look around and I got to decide with my life, what am I going to make count? Isn't that what it comes down to? A lot of times people just don't do that till it's too late. You know, we've just sort of rushed through life. We've done the things that were urgent and put our time and our energy into all these sorts of activities. And we haven't really thought it through to decide, this is what's really important. And I think one of the saddest things that can happen, and I see this, is that people have in their mind, this one part of my life is really important. For example, they'll say, my family is really important to me. Most people say that. And yet, what my heart and soul is being poured into might be my career. And I've seen a lot of people wake up when their kids are, you know, in their teens or older and realize, when that kid was born, I thought this kid is the most important thing in my life and I want to invest in him. And yet they've grown up and they don't even know him now. And it's sad. And it's because there was a thought priority, a perceived priority, but then the actions in life didn't line up with that priority. You know, because you got to make specific decisions in your life. Otherwise, there's just this current of life that just keeps us so busy. The Bible calls it the world system, that it's actually created by God's enemy to kind of sweep us along and keep us so busy and so preoccupied that we don't do the things that really matter. And it's sad. It ruins a life. You know, in the same way we look and we, as a parent would, a lot of us, you know, you come in here and you hear the word taught like this. And you realize this is significant. That spiritual leadership, being able to have a spiritual impact on other people's lives, this is significant. And I think somebody should do that. And I joke about that because when you think somebody should do that, it's the Holy Spirit calling to you. Yeah. This is something that you could do. But most of the time, it doesn't mean that you can just sort of go along with things as they are and just sort of stack this on, because the plate's usually full already. And so it comes to a time when you sort of have to have a summit with yourself or maybe with your spouse or your family, and you kind of reevaluate where we're investing our energy, our time, and our resources. And it may mean things would change. You think, that sounds scary. It is scary in a way to think of changing the way that we do things. But I'll tell you, the rewards, God will bless you beyond anything that you can imagine. He will. He'll bless you for this. And I'm not saying this to, make some sort of empty promise to you and say, we're so desperate for leaders here that we got to promise a bonus, a signing bonus or something like that. We're not. Because, my belief is that God calls people to this, but then each of us has to choose. But I think of the difference in my life because God called me to this, and in some steps along the way, I said yes to him. And, I just look around this room, and I look at the friends that I have, really close friends, people that will tell me the truth about things in my life, people that when I'm hurting are there beside me and have been for years. And I look around at a lot of my peers that have just pursued, as a physician and coming out of medical school, and now guys, my peers that are in their 50s now and have lived for those values, that is, more and more and more. So many of them, their lives are so tragic right now. Divorce, loneliness. You talk to people around, and especially men, they don't have friends that are really close to them that they can call out to and enjoy. And it's sad. It's sad, and it doesn't have to be that way. You see, and I think one of God's big answers here is this very aspect of the way he structured things. That as we lead together, some of my closest friends are the ones that we've faced real difficult times in leadership together. Like Jody Keir and I, we lived together. We went to second grade together. You guys know Jody. We played high school football together. When he was in dental school and I was in med school, we lived together, and then we started going to a home church together, and then we led a home church together, he and Sue and Laura and I, for years. And we went through a lot of things together, conflicts with each other, conflicts with other people. Jana Berrigan, I don't know if she's here, she was with us. And we faced messes together, and yet we really learned to love each other in that kind of a context. We work with the Rhodeses, and we've been with them for years. And, those kind of friendships are something that are really awesome. Last night, we went to a wedding. Some friends of ours, Luke Walker and Carrie Gladwell, they got married. And Walkers have been our friends since the kids were little. These were kids. I remember when they were all born, okay? Now they're getting married. My son's getting married next month, too. I remember when he was born, too. These kids, but I know, since I've gotten to be close friends with the Walkers, I know some of the things their son has gone through. And I know the Gladwells, not as well, but I know some of the things with their daughter. And to see the power of God in the lives of those families and in the lives of those children has changed my heart. And it changes my life, and it gives me a whole different perspective on the future. Because listen, there are so many things that could just tie us in knots of anxiety. Because we look at our own family, maybe our own kids, our own job situation. We see all these perils on the horizon, and we think, how can I survive this life? How can I? And when you're close enough and you've had these kind of relationships with people and you see God is faithful. God is faithful here and there. That's the way he is. It gives you a different perspective on the future. And you see, the only way you experience this is to be really engaged, though. if we're just sort of on the outside looking in, we get a glimpse, but we don't experience the true essence of what God has for each of us. And what I'm calling on you to consider is that making this more of a central part of our lives, where we think, all right, God, maybe you have something more for me, where I can come into this deeper kind of relationship with you and with other people and experience these kind of things. And I think we don't just seek it out for the sake of the experience. We seek it out for following God into the truth. But I think what we need to realize is if we just decide, well, I want to just stay in the stands and spectate, God's patient. He'll let you. He's not going to wrestle you down or anything like that. But there's something you give up, and there's something sweet that you won't get to experience. And so I would just say there's more. I'd like to see many people step forward with this kind of a commitment, say, I would like to lead spiritually with other people as God has fit for me. And it leads to a whole different life. Well, let's look then at verse 14. He says, brothers and sisters, we urge you to warn those who are lazy, encourage those who are timid, take tender care of those who are weak, be patient with everyone. Well, he's talking about warning the lazy, encouraging the timid, and taking care of the weak. Here again, if you've got this institutional view of church, who should be doing all this? The pastor. You know, there's somebody over here that needs warned. Who should do it? My home church leader should. That's not what the passage says. He says the whole rank and file of the church needs to be involved in giving each other this sort of input. And he says, we urge you, entreat. And this is a very strong term. He's like, this is something that each of you. And when you see how this, if you look at verse 27. He says, I command you in the name of the Lord to read this letter to all the brothers and sisters. So this letter was read to everyone. So when he emphasized this point, it was to the whole church. We urge you. He says, first, warn those who are lazy. The New American Standard says, admonish the unruly. And they did have a problem here in Thessalonica with a work ethic that was wanting. In fact, in 2 Thessalonians, he says, if you won't work, then you won't eat either. That's a pretty strong warning. Okay. So don't rely on charity here if you're able to work. But there is at the base of this, it shows that there are certain instances where we really need a strong correction. This was, in a way, life-threatening to this church, where there were these people that were just floating around. They were busybodies. They were undermining what was going on in the church. And he says, the word admonish is translated warm here, nutheteo. And it means, it's a very strong term for correction. Again, we don't like to talk about that, but he says there are certain cases where that's what people need. There are certain times when I need that. He says, then there's those that need encouragement. They're afraid. They know the right thing to do, and yet they're afraid to do it. And here again, that's why we have the scriptures. That's why we have each other. That's why we're not here by ourselves. He says, we bear one another's burdens. We need encouragement because we are fragile people. And so we should not expect that we can just go on our own, and we shouldn't look at our friends and say, come on, get it together. Know that we encourage. And then he says we take tender care. So here's the idea. This word that's translated take tender care, it's like wrapping your arms around this person. Here's a person that is shattered. You know what it's like. A lot of us know what it's like to be shattered with disappointments, problems that we've had or in our family or something like that. And what we need at that point is for someone to wrap their arms around us, and we can lay our head on their shoulder and weep. And so see this spectrum of attention and input that the scriptures call on us to give to one another, to warn, to encourage, to wrap our arms around people. And he says, but what should be the foundation of all this? Look at that. That's the last verse. Be patient. Be patient with everyone. And this word that's translated be patient comes from an Old Testament word. It's the word macrothumia. And it, in the Old Testament, it's translated long-suffering for God. God, long-suffering or the patience of God. That's the predominant use of this in the Old Testament scripture. And Paul's picking up on that in the New Testament. And it means that he's willing to wait. He's willing to wait. So when you think of a lot of these situations, what is it about patience? Why do we need patience? Well, it's because there's a delay. It's not happening on the time schedule that I've prescribed, so I'm agitated, or I'm frustrated, or I'm angry. Anybody here feel that way? I'm impatient. But the model, what we need to think of to get a good picture of this is God's patience or God's long-suffering. Because that's what this is drawn out from. Because here's God, okay? And what God is that's different than us is that he's righteous. That means he's perfectly good. And so when there's humanity that's not perfectly good, in fact, the Bible says we're sinful and that our sin has made a separation between us and God. And that our sin brings us under the righteous judgment of God. So if God was not long-suffering or patient, what would he do? Immediately, boom, judgment. It'd be over. Right from the beginning, the first humans that sinned and turned away from God's authority, it would have been over at that moment in time. And yet the scriptures say that God's love for humanity has caused him to be patient. To exercise macrothumia, long-suffering. And so what God has decided through the ages is that even though that our sin has made a separation between us, that we deserve his judgment now, he says, I'm going to wait and I'm going to reveal a different way. A way that I will pay for that sin. The way that my justice and my love will come together. And he did that then in the Old Testament. He prefigured all this through this sacrificial system, all pointing to the ultimate sacrifice, which would be Jesus' death on the cross. You see, and all this demonstrates God's patience. And he gives us then today the way he demonstrates that to each of us is he reveals himself to us. That his spirit is active. That Jesus says, if I'm lifted up, I'll draw all people to myself. I'll convict the world of sin, righteousness, and judgment. And the thing is, if for those investigating Christianity not sure about all this, the thing to realize is that God's patience is working towards you. That he is revealing himself. It's not an accident that you're here and you're hearing this kind of thing. Because he's revealing himself to you in this personal way to show you, really in your heart of hearts, that you need to be forgiven. That you fall under his judgment. You know, we don't like to hear that. What do you mean, judgment? Well, I mean, if he's God and I'm me, he's got the right to do what he wants. And his patience operates to reveal himself to each of us, but see, the scriptures are real clear on another aspect, and that is that when it's over for us. It says in Hebrews, it says, for a man is appointed to die once, and then comes judgment, that we'll stand before him. And so there's an end to this process, but God is so loving that he's revealing himself to us in this process of life. And that turning to him, the Bible calls it repentance, is an acknowledgement that, okay, I realize I need to be forgiven, and I want that forgiveness from Jesus to apply to me. That's called a change in mind, a repentance of sorts. And it's a way then that we experience God's love and we see the outcome of his patience. And he's saying this same sort of patience that God exercises towards us is what then we can exercise towards other people. And I want you to think about this. Patience means we wait, and we wait not because of our faith in the person, but because of our faith in God. If we encourage people, if we warn people, if we wrap our arms around people and we're willing to wait for change and we don't demand it now, it's not because we have faith that this person is a great person. You know, that's optimistic humanism. A humanist says everybody's basically good, and if we just treat them that way, then the good will come out. Well, there is something that's good in people. That's the image of God. But there's also this evil part of people that has played itself out in the pages of history. And the view of humanity from the Christian perspective is that people filled with the Spirit of God and having God's leading in their life, they will change, they will grow, because God will not quit. And that's the faith that we have. That's why we can wait. When we see things going not the way we want them to, we can have a faith or a belief that God is in it. And he says, I will not forsake you. I won't quit. And I'm not going to quit on the people around you. So it's our faith in God that drives this, not our faith in people. And then verse 15, our last verse, it says, see that no one pays back evil for evil, but always try to do good to each other and to all people. And I just think, well, what's the purpose of this verse? Well, think of it in context of this talk about correction and everything. What's he saying? He's saying, hey, the motive for correction it should be love. If we're talking about how to correct people, it shouldn't be just because they've ticked you off. It should be because you care about them. It says, don't pay back evil for evil. If someone's done evil, think, how has this evil hurt them and the people around them, and how can I help them grow and change from this? That's what he's talking about here. So it gets down then to the motives again. Well, let's just talk for just a couple minutes about how this is all going to apply. I think what the scriptures call us to do is to love others. And the whole basis of the love that we give to others is the love that we've received from Christ. And he says it comes in different forms, that we can warn, we can encourage, we can take tender care, we're always patient. And the thing that I hope we can come away from here today is the realization that I need input too. I need this kind of input from other people. And I think we may find that we don't have many people that'll give us this kind of input, because we give them sort of the stiff arm. If they've tried to warn us, or they've tried maybe even to encourage us or to help us, that we push people away, that we feel like we get the willies just thinking about somebody being this close to us. And what I would say, as I thought about this, you can look at this warn, encourage, take tender care. You can say, well, these are the people that have problems out there in the church. You know, there's some people that need this kind of thing. But what I was thinking about is, for each of us, there's probably different areas in our lives, either today or that are coming up, that fit each one of these categories. Think, where is it in your life that you need somebody to kick your butt? We probably have something like that, where we're just off base, and if we'd admit it and we really wanted to change, we'd think, somebody needs to kick my butt in this area and to really bear down on me and help me with this. Maybe it's my anger. Maybe it's my materialism. Maybe it's, you know, my addiction problems. I don't know. Somebody really needs to help me in a strong way. I need warned. Then maybe there are areas where I need encouraged, where I sense God's calling me to do something, but I've just not followed through. I need someone to step alongside me and really help me with this area. And then there are probably areas where we need somebody to wrap their arms around us. And if we were honest about what was really going on in our heart, that there are things that we would like to weep about and talk about and have somebody come alongside us. And all that sounds kind of threatening in some ways, but it starts someplace, I guess, with having conversations with people and praying with people. And the end game of the whole thing is that people are closer and they get to experience God's love. And then finally, I'd just like to say, honor your leaders and be one. God's appointed spiritual leaders. He's calling more people. He says the harvest is plentiful, the workers are few. So I'm going to stop right there. Next week's Daniel.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.